On the eve of the cross, the night Jesus was betrayed, he gathered with his disciples in the upper room for a Passover meal. But this was no ordinary Passover meal any more than that was an ordinary Thursday night. Jesus transformed the Passover into a new meal. We know it now as the Lord's Supper or the Eucharist or communion. Jesus gave his church this meal as a way of continuing to commune with him after he completed his earthly ministry and ascended into heavenly glory. He left this meal behind that we might continue to have fellowship with him even after his ascent into heaven. The theme of the night in the upper room was love. Everything in the upper room was about love. The actions, the words, the rituals of the upper room are all about love, the love that Jesus has for his people and the love that his people are to show towards one another. Jesus gave his disciples an example of love. Jesus washing the disciples' feet was an act of love. It was an act of service. None of the other disciples were willing to perform this customary act. Their arrogance kept them from it, but Jesus did it. All authority was his. He was Lord and Master in that room. Indeed, he was Lord and Master of the universe in that very moment, and yet he stooped in humility to serve. And in doing so, he gave to his disciples an authoritative example to follow, an example of what love looks like. Love is humble. Love is about service. Love is about sacrifice. Jesus teaching in the upper room. So you've got his example. Jesus teaching in the upper room is also about love. We've already read this evening about the new commandment Jesus gave to his disciples that evening, that they are to love one another as they have been loved by Jesus. Now, people often ask, what's new about this commandment? Why is this called a new commandment? Certainly, it's not new in one sense. The Old Testament law, the Torah, already commanded love of neighbor. So there's nothing new about love or even the preeminence of love as the fulfillment of the law. It's been in the law from the beginning. It's an old commandment, you might say, to love. So why does Jesus call it new? Well, what's new in this commandment is the model of love Jesus gives to them. There's a kind of radicalness and a newness in this love that Jesus shows to his disciples that will give the commandment new meaning, new depth. Israel had never seen love quite like what Jesus was about to do. The world had never seen love quite like this. Jesus said he wants this amazing love to be the mark of his disciples, that this is how the world will recognize us as Jesus' disciples, by this kind of love, a love that can't be found anywhere else. Now, there's no question the church has often failed to live up to this standard. Listen to what John Frame, a theologian I really like, what John Frame has to say about this. He says, our theologies talk about the marks of the church, but love is the mark Jesus mentions, the mark that identifies us as Christ's disciples. In the first centuries, in the early church, the pagans noticed that love. It stuck out how these Christians loved one another. Today, the pagans tend to notice other things about us, the division, the splintering, the quarrelsome spirit. We need to learn again to love one another as Christ has loved us. We need to learn what it means to lay down our lives for one another. And John Frame is exactly right. This new command requires a new kind of love, a love that the world's not going to see anywhere else. And all too often, the church has failed to display that kind of love in the relationships between Christians. Jesus went on in the rest of his teaching in the upper room that night to explain a great deal more of what this love involves. In fact, if you look at not just John 13, but chapters 14, 15, and 16, you see this. Jesus keeps coming back to this theme of love and keeps expounding what this kind of love means. And then you've got the meal, the Lord's Supper, the original love feast. If we have the example of love and we have the teaching of love, we also have the feast of love. The church fathers referred to the Lord's Supper as divine love made food. And that's a glorious way to think about it. The Lord's Supper is ritualized love. The Lord's Supper is edible love. Jesus came to usher in a kingdom of love, and this meal sums up his kingdom. It's really a summary of what his kingdom is all about. The Lord's Supper is ritualized love. Now, I know that word ritual is sometimes used in a negative way, and sometimes it should be used in a negative way. But here I mean it positively. I'm using the word ritual or ritualized in a positive way. The Lord's Supper is ritualized love. It is a meal that is obviously to be repeated again and again and again. We do it every Lord's Day. I think that's a wonderful pattern. It's what I think you see in the scriptures. It's when you see it various times in church history. When the church has been at her best, she has had frequent celebrations of the Lord's Supper. But I think it's sometimes easy for us to think that if you repeat something again and again, then it automatically must be vain repetition. And the repetition empties the act of its meaning because it becomes so familiar. But we should not think about the Lord's Supper that way. Its frequency, its familiarity should not make it meaningless. Actually, it should show us what the meaning of the supper really is. I think it would be better to think about the repetition of the supper as training. God's rituals, like the Lord's Supper, are given to us to form us into the kind of people he wants us to be. When we do the ritual, when we do the supper in the way that he prescribes, with the words and actions and elements that Jesus commanded, it is transformative. It's transformative because Christ has promised to be present with us in this meal, and doing it according to the pattern he gave us forms and shapes and molds us in a certain way. You could say the Lord's Supper is faith, hope, and love all rolled into one. What do I mean by that? Well, think about it. When we come to the Lord's table, what do? We trust that Jesus will give himself to us at the table as he has promised. We hope that this feast is a foretaste of the final feast to come at the last day. And we experience Christ's love for us, and we express our love for one another in how we come to the table and share a meal together. And so true Christian community, true Christian fellowship flows out of this feast. It flows out of this feast into the rest of our daily lives. Life flows out of this feast. Love flows out of this feast. Love flows out of the love feast. The love that we experience and the love we share at the Lord's Supper is to characterize our lives every day. The feast forms fellowship. The feast demonstrates in word and action how Christ has loved us, how Christ gives himself to us, and therefore should serve as the model for how we are to love one another and give ourselves to one another. In John 13, Jesus stresses that love is not merely wishing others the best. Love is not merely a feeling. Love is demonstrated in action. Love is tangible. It can be seen. It becomes visible in action. When Jesus washes the disciples' feet, he's putting love on display. That's the embodiment of love. It's the same with the feast. Just as the bread and wine are tangible gifts of love, so in daily life, love is something that can be seen. It's observable. It's manifest in an action. It's every bit as tangible as the bread and wine of the Lord's Supper. In verse 17 of chapter 13, Jesus said, "If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them." If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. Knowing is not enough, you must do. Knowing is not enough, you must act. It's been said that a sermon is never rightly heard until it is put into practice, and that is especially true of Jesus' sermon in the upper room. Jesus is not just giving ideas to his disciples. He's not speaking about something that's abstract or theoretical. He wants to change the way his disciples live. It's a sermon that is to be translated into action, a sermon that is to be performed and acted out in daily life. You know, some Christians are all head, no hands. Some Christians are all head, no feet. They have stuffed their head full of truth, but they don't act any of it out with their hands or with their feet. And that's simply not sufficient. That's not adequate. It's not enough to know about love in our heads. We have to use our hands and our feet and everything else about us in loving ways, in loving actions. We're to offer the members of our bodies to love, to service, just as Jesus did when he stooped to his knees and used his hands to wash the disciples' feet. Love is not love until it is embodied. Love is not love until and unless it's translated into action. Love is sacrificial. Love is self-giving. Love is sacrificial, self-giving service. The kingdom of Jesus is summed up in this kind of love. The whole Christian faith can be summed up in this: my life for yours. That's what Jesus did on the cross, giving his life for us. We can't replicate that. We can't duplicate that, of course, exactly in the way that Jesus did. But we can make that our pattern of life. My life for yours. Jesus said later that evening, he said, "This is love, that a man lay down his life for his friends." That's what love is all about. That's what this kingdom is all about. It's a kingdom of love. It's this kind of love that is to characterize Jesus' kingdom. The blessing is found in the doing, not merely in the knowing or the feeling. And again, Jesus is the model. He loved his disciples in the upper room, and we are to love one another in the same way. He loves us, and he fills us with his love, and so we're to be overflowing with his love, so that when we love others, we're actually loving them with the love of Jesus. It's as if Jesus is loving others through us. Jesus loves us in such a way that we can participate in his love. And when we love one another in this way, we're actually showing them the love of Jesus. It's actually the love of Jesus flowing through us into the lives of other people. Maybe the best way to flesh this out, to flesh out what this love should look like, is to pivot from John 13 to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. I read 1 Corinthians chapter 13 at the very beginning of the night because I think it's a wonderful summary. Of course, it's a famous summary of what love is all about. I say pivot from John 13 to 1 Corinthians 13, but it's not really much of a pivot at all, because that famous love poem that Paul gives us is really about Jesus. In fact, I think you could say it's really about the upper room. God is love. Jesus is God. That means Jesus is love. Jesus is the very embodiment of God's love. Love is as Jesus does. Jesus is the very definition of love. If you want to know what love looks like, you simply look at Jesus. His life is a revelation of love. He is the standard of love. He is the source of love. Again, if you want to know what love looks like, you simply look at Jesus. I think 1 Corinthians 13 can be looked at as a summary of how Jesus lived. In fact, you could say it's really a summary of how Jesus lived in the Gospels. But maybe even more than that, I think 1 Corinthians 13 can be read as a kind of commentary or summary of what Jesus did for his disciples in the upper room in John chapter 13. And I can prove that to you. Take that love poem in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and anywhere it says love, simply insert the name Jesus. Insert Jesus for love, and you will see it has to be about Jesus, because only Jesus can really and truly and fully and perfectly love this way. Only Jesus embodies this kind of love to the fullest extent. Again, Jesus is the fountain of love. He's the fountain of this kind of love. Love like this flows from Jesus. So try it out. I'm going to read part of 1 Corinthians 13, plugging in Jesus for love. Listen to this. Jesus suffers long and is kind. Jesus does not envy or parade himself or boast. Jesus does not behave rudely. Jesus does not seek his own. Jesus is not provoked. Jesus thinks no evil. Jesus does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in truth. Jesus bears all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Jesus never fails. You see how true that is? You see how right that is? This is a wonderful description of Jesus in the upper room. It's a wonderful description of the kind of community Jesus wants to form his church into. This is how Jesus wants his disciples to live. Think about what Jesus was doing in that upper room. Jesus was long-suffering. 1 Corinthians 13 says love is long-suffering. Jesus was long-suffering towards his disciples in the upper room. Disciples who later that night would betray him and abandon him. in his moment of greatest need, he was long-suffering towards them. Jesus was kind to them. He showed them kindness in washing their feet. He was kind even to his enemy, Judas. Jesus did not envy or parade himself or boast. Indeed, his humility was on display as he washed their feet. We've seen that. Jesus was not self-seeking. Everything he did for their good and for their benefit. He was self-giving and sacrificial. Jesus is not doing anything for himself there. Jesus is serving the good of his disciples. Jesus did not allow himself to be provoked by their ignorance or by their arrogance. Jesus was self-controlled because love is self-controlled. Love is not easily offended, and Jesus was not offended by the fact that none of the disciples could understand what he was doing, what he was teaching them, how he was leading them. They couldn't really understand his mission and often tried to interfere with his mission, but Jesus, he's a man on a mission, and he continues plowing ahead to fulfill that mission. Jesus is not easily offended. Jesus is thick-skinned and tender-hearted. That's how Jesus lived. That's what his love looks like. Jesus never rejoiced in iniquity. Of course, Jesus did rejoice in righteousness. And this is why you can't just say, as so many in our culture want to today, you can't just say love is love, as though anything done in the name of love, you know, as long as you say you're acting in love, it's fine whatever you do, that love can take any form or shape you want it to take. No. Love rejoices in righteousness. Love does not rejoice in iniquity. You know, today people will say, well, if you love somebody, you have to affirm them in all their choices. You have to affirm them in their lifestyle and whatever they want to do. But that's not love at all, because love never rejoices in iniquity. Love rejoices in righteousness. Love is defined by God's law. And love delights in God's law. Love is tied to righteousness. Love rejoices in righteousness and in truth. And so a culture like ours, a culture like ours that rejects God's law and rejects the authority of God's word, really cannot love. We might talk about love a lot, but we know nothing of true love. A culture that rejects righteousness has no clue what love actually is. Only those who rejoice in righteousness properly understand love. And this is why love sometimes has a hard edge. Love disciplines, love confronts. Love can be what we might call tough love. Love rebukes and love corrects and love leads. Sometimes love will refuse to affirm. You know, the world will say, love makes you do crazy things. You know, love takes over and who knows what's going to happen. Love can carry you away. Love can make you do crazy things. No. Love does not make you crazy. Sin makes you crazy. Selfishness makes you crazy. Sin makes you do crazy things. Love does not. Love makes you patient and kind and righteous. Love makes you wise and self-controlled and humble. That's what real love does. And that's why real love is found in Jesus. And the love of Jesus never fails. The love of Jesus endures. The love that flows from Jesus never fails. It endures. It is eternal. It's important to remember when we read 1 Corinthians 13 that the Corinthian church was a very messed up church. It was a very divided church. It was a church with a lot of problems, a lot of sin, a lot of immaturity. Most of Paul's letter to the Corinthians, and you can think of the whole letter to the Corinthians as a love letter, but most of it is taken up with correcting their sins, their abuses, their divisions, their immaturities. There's so much that the Corinthians were confused about. They were just as confused about love in the first century as we are in the 21st century. And Paul writes this letter in love to set them straight, because that's what love does. Paul gives them this love poem in chapter 13, right in the middle of addressing all kinds of moral and doctrinal problems in the church. But the reason Paul puts the poem to love, the hymn to love there in the latter, is because he wants them to see that with all these problems they have, the solution, the answer to all of their problems really is love. It really is the love of Jesus. If you understand love in terms of Jesus, then love really is the answer. You know, again, the world loves to sloganize in ways that are incredibly misleading. The world will say things like, all you need is love. But the world doesn't know what love is. It only works to say love is all you need if you're talking about Jesus' love. Because then what you're saying is Jesus is all you need. And of course, that's true. Jesus is all you need. The love of Jesus is all you need. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 is the standard of love for the church. This is the kind of love that should mark out the community of Jesus' disciples. When Jesus said, I want you to be known by your love, this is the kind of love he's talking about. It's described in 1 Corinthians 13. And it is true. We need to learn how to practice this kind of love, this kind of humble love, this kind of long-suffering love, this love that expresses itself in kindness, this love that endures. We need to express this love in our own individual lives. But don't lose sight of the fact that Paul is talking to the church. He's talking to them corporately, as a body, as a congregation. It's the community Jesus has in view in John 13. It's the community Paul has in view in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Now, I'll tell you, I think our congregation, TPC here, I think our congregation does a very good job of loving one another. I think anybody from the outside looking in on our church would see this is a congregation of people, a community of people who really do love one another. They love one another sacrificially. They serve one another. Our church is a loving church. I want to commend you in that. I think Jesus would commend us in that. And the love that we have for one another really is a display of Jesus' love. It's really putting Jesus' love on display. And like every other church, I say all that, but then let me add this. Like every other church, no matter how mature it is or how faithful it is or how loving it is, we can do better. We can grow in our love, our Jesus-like love for one another. And so this is what I want you to think about as I conclude this tonight. Flowing out of this Monday-Thursday love feast, let's renew our commitment to love one another in a John 13, 1 Corinthians 13 kind of way. Flowing out of this service tonight, let's renew our commitment and our resolve to love one another in a Jesus-shaped, Jesus-sourced kind of way. Look at those crosses on your table. Okay, look at those crosses. That's what Christian love looks like. It's cruciform. What Jesus did in going to the cross is what we are to do for one another. Your life should be cruciform, cross-shaped, Christ-shaped. This kind of love, that's what it's all about. Our goal should be able to plug the name of our church into this chapter, into 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and it resonate as truth. Because we're really doing these things. Because as a church, we're being conformed more and more to the image of the one who is love incarnate. We're being conformed more and more to the image of Jesus. Jesus gives his love to the church, and his love then empowers his church to love. See, Jesus pours his love into us, and then we can overflow with this love to others. We love one another because he first loved us. His love is the source of our love. His love gives our love its shape. And so 1 Corinthians 13 should be the mark by which our church is known. It should be what characterizes our church, our community, our corporate life together, our fellowship, our friendships. It should look like 1 Corinthians 13. So the goal should be this. Listen to this. I'm going to go back through 1 Corinthians 13, and I'm going to plug our church's name into it, because this is the goal. This is what we're striving for. TPC suffers long. TPC is a kind congregation. TPC is not full of envy or pride or boasting. TPC does not behave rudely. TPC does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil. TPC does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in truth. TPC bears all things, hopes all things, endures all things. TPC never fails. And what it means to say never fails is to say our love for one another never fails. Where there should be love, there is love. When love should be manifested, it is manifested. This should be our prayer. This should be our goal. This should be our aim, to be this kind of community. By the grace of God, this can happen. By the love of Jesus, as his love strengthens us and as his love empowers us, we can do these things. He has loved us, and so let us love one another with the same love. He has poured his love into us. Let us overflow with that love into the lives of one another. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen.